Hello and welcome to edition 422 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
Today on the show, Noma Bar, the Israeli illustrator and graphic artist whose genius works play with perception and space. He'll be talking us through his new retrospective, Bittersweet, a little later.
Talking of sweetness, we'll also be taking a mid-show breather to turn everything all summer weekly as we enjoy some gelato over in Belgrade. Monocle's Guy Delorne will be telling us more about that unconventional pairing.
And how's this for a palate cleanser, Rob? We'll end with a musical history lesson in the genre of heavy metal. Comedian and author Andrew O'Neill will be here to discuss the best of spandex and the dark arts at the end of the show.
All that plus Monocle's Bill Luty will be rocking some big stories with the news look ahead, and we'll play some great music too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we go, Tom. Are you feeling summery?
I couldn't feel any more summery if
really?
I was out on a lounger or a lilo.
How many puffs did it take you to inflate a lilo? Don't make
that
face.
I wondered what
you were going to ask you there.
Where were we headed? How many puffs does it take? Oh, a good few to really get nicely inflated.
Good, well, that's good news. I'm just trying to keep it summary because we're looking ahead to all sorts of summer content here on Monocle 24. And indeed, what we might call our sister thing, Monocle, the magazine, and Monocle, the Summer Weekly, which is a newspaper, which for some reason we're doing.
It's true. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's like one of those slightly tricky ones, isn't it? A mother-sister type.
What kind of relationship do you think the radio station and the, what is it?
I don't know. It's like something from Macbeth or maybe Oedipus.
Possibly that. At the very best, like two children fighting in the back of a car.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Will you just pipe down?
Exactly. Would you give young Alfred a sort of iPad as a distraction? Or
occasionally, but then he'll probably just open the window and jettison it onto the highway to be crushed beneath the wheels of an articulated vehicle.
And the iPad too.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to the summer. As we said, we're going to ping some summer content through this edition of the Monocle Weekly.
That's right. And actually, this show will be becoming more the Monocle Summer Weekly, like our weekly August newspaper, over the next few weeks. So that you'll positively feel the rays, Rob, during the next few weeks.
I can't believe that another editorial team has been drafted into Monocle in order to do this whole other summer newspaper. How on earth do these other staff do this other thing
it's
on top of Monocle magazine and the radio station?
You're right that you can't believe it.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it, almost like it's not happening. Shall we? It's Bill Lucy's turn to do the news look ahead, and I always love it when Bill does it. Shall we roll him into the studio?
Why don't you get your siren song to beckon him in?
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you?
And here he is, Bill Luty.
Hi.
It's the Monocle Weekly. What is happening in the week ahead?
Well, it's a news desert, quite frankly, but
we could play another song, Bill.
Let's just do that.
No, we can't. We can contractually obliged.
Play Bill's exit music straight away.
Yeah, exactly.
Sashay out the studio.
It's a P45, a sweet P45.
So as well as my firing next week, we've got, in substitute for actual news, last week was Shark Week. I'm not quite sure what that means. You have to celebrate sharks.
You have to look after those cuddly creatures.
I know,
They're deeply misunderstood. Some great whites have over 200 teeth.
That's enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that's good.
Plenty. No wonder they're so keen to...
Plenty of
Bill,
teeth.
Bill, Tom's got more facts than you so far in this section of the programme.
Out-facted. Be careful saying that.
We're going to do some animal news.
Great.
Because there are a number of celebrations, perhaps, of different animals. We'll start with World Cat Day. That's on Tuesday. The International Fund for Animal Welfare has decided to celebrate all things feline.
Imagine the social media streams. It's going to be a day of unbelievable cat gifts.
Well, all people do on the internet anyway is look at cats. So what's going to happen? They're going to have to double down.
Is that still... Because I understood that the internet was created as a forum for pornography and then it segued into...
It's become more disappointing since then. With, you know, news and cat videos.
We've not crested that wave of cat videos. There's still more to come.
There's more...
I don't know. I'm interested.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering if you had any good cat stories.
I was just going to make a few cat puns. That's all I could think of.
Okay. Should I tell you my...
I'm not feline-like it anymore.
Hey!
Shall I tell you my cat story?
Yeah.
My granddad had a black cat my dad and his siblings loved very much. And one day he drove home late at night and he didn't see the cat and he ran it over, which is very sad.
Bill, I have to say, your stories are quite
depressing. Is that the end? That's not the end of the story, though.
No, so to camp, presumably. So as a, he thought, don't worry, we'll get a new cat. Don't want to run it over in the dark. He got a white one. Very cold winter that year.
Ran it over on a snowy day.
Ran it over in the snow.
Brilliant.
That is properly brilliant.
That's really good, isn't it?
But sad.
Okay.
Is this your dad?
My granddad, yeah.
Your granddad?
He doesn't have any cats anymore.
Okay.
But he is a member.
Did he need to get his eyes
tested? He's
probably
not allowed to get any cats anymore.
Yeah.
He is a member of the
And then he bought a ginger cat, and then, of course, he got a job at the marmalade factory. reverse into that guy.
I'm trying to think of other cat colorations that could work on this thing.
Yeah, I don't really know.
We'll get to it.
Tortoise shell. There's not any surface that's tortoiseshell coloured.
It's a difficult one to reconcile with a joke, isn't it, that one?
Back to my granddad, who is a member of the worldwide organisation The Lions Club. It's only Lions Day on Thursday.
Is it the main event that day, Bill? Robust puns.
You've been practising these, haven't you?
Yes, yeah. I have.
We'll fly through some others. World Elephant Day on Saturday.
So for these animal days, are they kind of all packed into a week then? Is this animal week and it's like cat day, dog day, guinea pig day, iguana day?
It's because they know
squashed in
that no one's going to have anything else on.
Okay.
It is that kind of silly season time of the year. And why not? If the news agenda has freed up some thinking time, why not think about some of our animal counterparts?
I think it's a good thing. Friends. In fact, we were just talking in the week about Ralph Steadman, the estimable cartoonist and artist who's doing a book of his latest series is about endangered animals. I think we should get him in this program.
That would be fantastic.
In the next few weeks to talk about this. And we can then give some sort of bolster,
some actual weight heft
to the you know, whack this golf ball that Bill's teed up elegantly off the first tee.
I reckon we'd hit it would
land, get Ralph into
land
that.
Straight on the green, wouldn't it, if Ralph came in?
Yeah. So that's Elephant Day. When's that?
That's Saturday.
Okay.
And then, not quite as good, same on Saturday, what's known as the Glorious 12th, for people who know.
That's shooting grouse, isn't it?
Is
that's
the beginning of the grouse season.
You've gone from celebrating animals to celebrating, essentially, hunting and killing animals.
I thought all of these days were about eating them. I was just flicking through online some cat
liver recipes. I told you, you're not allowed to eat.
Recipes,
you have to stop eating endangered animals at work. I like sort of animal theme. Any other animal attractions coming up?
That's it.
It's less good for if you're a grouse listening. Well, we've given them advance warning.
We have.
Ship out.
Maybe you could head to the National Hobo Convention in Iowa, which is taking place next Saturday. I thought this was like offensive.
Is that because that's a tramp, right? That's American parlance for a tramp.
No, but these are the proper guys who literally ride the old railroads and all this kind of thing.
Oh, interesting you should say that, because there's a difference between a hobo and a tramp. A hobo travels and works. A tramp travels but does not work.
Sorry, all hobos.
And there's bitter rivalry between the two groups, because the hobos think that the tramps are lazy because they don't do any work.
Quickly, what happens at the hobo convention? They get together and have a bit of a chinwag and...
Yeah, 2,000 hobos all come down. Other members of the public are allowed, and everything pretty much is free. They just.
Where is it? In Iowa.
What is it? A big barbecue and things?
Yeah, they cook loads of food. They just hang out. There's one secret council meeting that only the hobos are allowed to attend, and then they crown this year's hobo king and queen.
Oh, that's a really interesting thing. I wonder how one is sort of. I wonder how you get into the hobo brotherhood, sisterhood.
Mm. It's apparently like a really tight community.
Because it's kind of some sort of Masonic thing, presumably. Mm. Because you can just turn up.
They all have
look a little bit like you're a weather-beaten kind of cat, but there must be some kind of initiation, maybe.
I bet there's some really obvious tells. It'd be interesting to speak to someone from the association. I bet they can say, you know, you're bogus,
Quickly you can swing your legs over a 5-bar gate and onto a railroad track.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
There's definitely still something romantic about that idea of riding the railroads.
Isn't
there? This old going west, it goes back to those, you know, Thomas Wolfe and all that. So I don't know, there's something... Well, it probably actually wasn't that romantic. It's probably about as tough a life as you could get. But there's definitely something appealing about it.
There's something very free about that. I love that.
Well, head over.
See you on the other side. Thank you very much, Bill. We'll be speaking to artist Noma Barr after this.
Israeli illustrator and artist Noma Bar's work has appeared in publications ranging from the New York Times to Time Out and picked up by brands such as Penguin Books and Coca-Cola. He's known for images that always warrant a second look because they're beautiful, of course, but Noma's playful use of negative space means there's often hidden messages contained within.
Now he's compiled some of his favourite images for a new retrospective book called Bittersweet, which arrives as 5 lavish volumes contained in a hardback case, and he joins us now to talk us through it. Noma, first of all, congratulations on the book and welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
I've always loved your work since I can't remember where I first saw it, but I mean, it's so standout. It's one of those things. This is the $64 million question. Maybe it's worth more than that. You can tell us at the end or secretly. When did you kind of arrive on this signature style, meshing kind of two worlds into one image? When did that kind of click?
I think it's really hard because people don't see us. But if you open Pretty Ugly, right, which is the blue book, you can see my drawings when I was 9 years old. And the mashup was there. If you look on the details, it's portraits of my neighbors. But they were not normal portraits. So one of them was a smoker, and I used his teeth as lighter, using the nose and as balloon. So this kind of metaphor and double thinking was there. And through the years, I obviously developed it and experiment with more and more. I always used to draw things and discover more things in them. So it's kind of endless search and of discoveries. I think in college, probably...
Then you define it and you refine it.
I started to define it. This is where I started to work with typography. I studied Hebrew type design, and we had a lot of exercises to draw on the negative space. I'm not going to use my hands because that's not useful. I started to draw, if you'll think of the letter A, so it's a triangle inside the letter A and the space under it. So we used to do it like handmade when I studied. That was when computer just entered graphic design, so everything was handmade. And I had a lot of negative space exercises, which is a slightly different thing from combining two things. Negative space is one way to do it.
And was there something about learning in Hebrew first, being from Israel originally? Is it an alphabet that lends itself to a more graphic awakening of it, if you know what I mean?
I'm not sure that for what I'm doing, I'm not sure that it's the Hebrew thing, but there's definitely something about losing my language, which was leading me to what I'm doing. And I'm not sure that if I would stay in Israel, I would do the same thing, because I studied type design and Hebrew calligraphy. And I came to London with portfolio, with works in Hebrew, most of them, and realized that there's no demand to Hebrew typographers in London.
People scratching their heads going, this is beautiful, what does it mean?
And I started to look on my hands and look in the mirror again and started to draw my hands. And it became almost like a sign language of icons and drawings. And this is how negative space gone more, because I wanted to say more things. So this is how things develop. I'm not sure that the connection is to Hebrew directly, but losing your language when you come and you study and you want to communicate with language like typography. And it's a bit like actor that moved to a foreign country, that he cannot express himself with words. And I couldn't express myself with typography because I felt that Latin letters are not doing what Hebrew letters are doing to me. This is how things started. I become more and more quiet and more visual and more into iconography and icons that will tell the story without using language in a way.
I want to ask you about that, Noah, because it's interesting to me that we talk. I mean, I described you in the introduction as an illustrator and artist. I don't know whether are you interested in the labels that people put on you, because even to talk about graphic design, you know, it used to be called commercial art, you know, back in the day. Do those kinds of things matter, those labels? Do you worry how people perceive it, as long as they're perceiving it somewhere?
No, I don't. And through the years, you know, when I first came out, so portraits was out, and I defined as someone who's doing caricature or caricaturist, and then other things came out, and I become a graphic designer and graphic artist, and then editorial, and then I become illustrator and everything. No, I'm not.
Not bothered.
No, I'm not bothered.
Have you ever told anyone on a plane that you're a doctor?
What I've noticed all the time, that when I say illustrator, people see cartoons and Mickey Mouse. So this is how people define illustration. So I'm less saying illustration because it's not exactly that. I think that graphic art is probably the word that's kind of the term that define everything together.
There is obviously a lot of biography in your pictures, especially, you know, when you do something. I think you said your first moment was when you realised that Saddam Hussein's face looked like a radiation mm-hmm. symbol. And there is a lot of biography in your portraits of the well-known. I saw your picture of Obama when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and latterly Trump as well. Mm-hmm. Is this something...
The two Ronnies, Rob, don't forget.
And the two favorite. Ronnies, which is obviously my personal favourite, of course. Now we're talking of the great world leaders, Ronnie Paulbert, yeah. of course, amongst them. Do you have to be sort of careful about the two things that you are conflating together, the rifle with the man's face, or the, you know,
I think it depends on the illustration of yeah. the brief. It's all start on the brief, and some of them, like Saddam, was a personal discovery, and a lot of them it thinks that I suddenly see something and I sketch it and I don't know when it's going to be out, and some of them are commissioned work, so this is probably when the person biography will come in, or they want to say, or the text will say something. This is where my more illustrator role come in, when I'm illustrating a text. So this is where, you know, I can pick things on the person biography. They mm-hmm. might be controversial or not. I don't know if you see Berlusconi, so he's with naked lady in his yeah. face.
Of
so
course, of course.
So it's things like that that comes from the
story.
Well,
that was a photograph.
But, you know, the whole thing, it's sometimes they come from reality, and a lot of time they come from the story, Diana portrait, so... the camera and the paparazzi story. So that was the story from New York Times. And so I think you can see difference between them. Some of them, when it comes to portrait, just one thing that sums the whole personality. Some of them telling a very specific story that relates to a written story.
Time or a new story or something yeah. that's very specific. Because there's a wonderful story of Chechnya and Russia, and it's the bear with the... That's a beautiful piece yeah. of work. Are people be interested to know how much words you get in a brief from the New Yorker or the New York Times?
Sometimes I get the whole copy, sometimes just the headline.
Yeah, is it useful to have the whole thing, or is it sometimes you just want a summary?
Sometimes it's just distracting, because I don't like to illustrate bits of the copy. I like to step back and look at the whole copy and try to capture the whole story. So in some cases, I don't need the whole story. I just need the headline, or I just need a few words. And that's it.
I want to ask you a bit about, well, just leafing through Les Moore, the yellow book at random. And there's a brilliant one that Rob and I noticed earlier, which was the sort of the helmets of James Hunt and Niki Lauda. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but there's the negative space is a racing car, which is the sort mm-hmm. of visors of the two helmets. With an idea like that, what do you do? Are you kind of sketching stuff freehand and then you see that suddenly the racing car appears? Or I'm interested in the actual sort of metabolism of the idea.
Go on this one. So it's getting the brief from Empire magazine. I used to work with them on every month and do illustrations. Yeah, they will send me the brief, which in that case, it's probably a few words. Just do something about the film. And then I'll watch the film and I'll start to sketch. I go to Highgate Wood, where I work every day, and I start to sketch. And it might start from their portrait or people, driver sitting in the car. I start to look for different angles. And suddenly, on this case, I just realized, okay, something happened on the helmet. And then I had one side of the helmet. And then I thought, okay, and it all happened while I'm kind of talking to myself and drawing, you know, kind of thinking, not loud. That would be too weird in the middle of the week. But yeah, suddenly I discover another helmet, and okay, that could be the other side. So it's not planned, and it's one thing that led to another thing, very spontaneous. I could end up with something completely different, and I cannot calculate what's going to happen at the end. I give myself a certain time for sketching and discoveries. But this got even better and better, because they had quite iconic helmets as well. One was black with two lines. So suddenly the lines of his helmet become the wind of the car.
Is that a bit of like serendipity? It gets better and better, and the layers.
So sometimes it gets better, yeah. For example, realizing that the lines could be the speed lines was a bit later. But everything starts from hand sketch. So this is what I'm doing during the day. I'm working and sketching with my sketchbook. And in the evening, I'm executing it on my computer. So when I execute as well, there's a lot of other surprises that can happen.
Yeah, are things unveiled, or do things become apparent in the process? Because of course you sit there, and people will be. Let's not rush past this interesting detail. You work in Highgate Wood.
Yeah,
I read this about you, and I'm glad you've backed us up, because I didn't know. I was like, this is a bit of a strange thing to do. If someone just claimed they've seen Noma
in Highgate Wood.
Yeah, lurking behind a fir
tree. They're not going to find me, because it's probably in some hidden
corner.
Full
camo.
Not full, but yeah, kind of semi-full. Yeah, I don't
really
want to be seen. I'm sitting in quiet area, so it wouldn't be in the center of the.
Don't worry, we're not going to send people off and come and find you.
No,
and
it's so,
to sign
it's so
the
big.
Book or something. Why training, is that a good place? So, to make your art.
We found a nice flat in Highgate. We didn't know about Highgate Wood, and we crossed the road, and then we saw the wood. We wanted the flat before the wood, and then we saw the wood, and we said, that's it. Why wood? I've been in woods all my life.
Okay.
My father was, how you define it, like a forest. It's like charity that protect the trees. And,
okay.
And he was responsible of planting all the north of Israel in the 50s, 60s.
Okay.
In Nazareth area, I live near Nazareth. It's like, it's unbelievable. It's in the north of Israel. But for all my childhood, I thought that these trees are ours. You know, my father was very personal about it, and they used to plant trees, and they were kind of pioneering on the mountains, and yeah. I was there with him. So most of my childhood, I was in woods, never felt belong to woods, and I think writing on it on rough smooth as well, on the gray one. So I like the contradiction between cities and nature, yeah. Never felt belong there, and I worked with really, you know, kind of aggressive farmers in holidays. He used to leave me there in the wood, and he used to chop trees and things like that. And I felt that's something else in these cities. And,
yeah.
And in, I prefer the concrete to nature. I couldn't appreciate what he showed me and what, you know, the nature and this kind of beauty. You don't appreciate it as a teenager, you know. And then I found myself, you know, looking for that after living in London and living in Tel Aviv and living in cities, looking for nature. And I think Highgate Wood was just amazing combination of great balance of probably on my way back. So I will cross through the wood on my way to the studio from here. So I like this kind of city countryside balance.
Yeah, me too.
And it helps me, and it's very quiet.
There are lots of dogs there though, and there's an excellent pair of Labradors meeting as only dogs meet.
Yeah,
which is one of my favourites. And I used to walk my dog in Highgate Wood, so I can emphasise. I used to live in Muswell Hill in Highgate.
All right.
Indeed, so. And because there's Waterlow Park, there's the birds.
They don't go there. It's too manicured, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not very wild.
Yeah, it's all kind of very thick. So I go from time to time, but every time I go back to Highgate Wood, which is kind of so brutal and wild.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
It's an interviewer's dream to find such a neat sort of line between someone's sort of perceived biography and the work that they make, right? This duality all the time, the woods and the Israel, and then coming to London and finding Highgate and working and the quietness of it.
I'm looking for this duality.
You're always
time.
Looking for that tension
for
between
tension,
two things.
Black and white.
Yeah,
left,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
It's fascinating.
I was
stuff.
Born to that. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I was born to conflict, Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
It was there. It was in projects in college. These two sides, which kind of it was a burden on my shoulders, you know, in my life, this kind of being between two sides, and especially when I left Israel and look at those sides from distance, it's there all the time. So they're not just two things that come together. There's a kind of probably wider meaning behind those two things that I keep looking.
We'll have to discuss that next time you come in for the second behemoth of a book. One thing, your style is so recognisable, rightly so. I wonder if when you break out and sketch a postcard to someone when you're on holiday, whether you break out of that style, whether it's just a relief to leave that at the door. And I know that there's a book of other stuff, which is earlier stuff, and some of your peripheral stuff. How often does that make it out of the studio?
It's happened all the time, you know. It happened on the train here, and I'm all the time, but it's the same thing in the meaning. So if I draw someone on the train on the way here, someone else will sit on his place after a second, and suddenly I will draw the other person on the, again, I'm using my hand, I will draw the other person on the negative space of his shoulder in a way. So the technique might be different because the train will be shaky and I'm going to draw it very quickly, but the structure and the thinking behind it, it's all the time the same. And even if you look at, you know, some really abstract things there on rough smooth and completely wild and doesn't look like my work, when you look again, you will see the DNA of my work. And rough smooth was done in really kind of rough conditions of trains, aeroplanes, while I'm walking in the rain, which kind of deliberately breaking the graphic neat side. Again, those two sides. And probably someone who is really, really neat wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing as well, because if you're really, really neat and precise, you can't just break things and start again. What I'm doing here is kind of requires a lot of flexibility, and I need to think fast and to do things and throw them away and start again. And probably the other side helped me as well, this kind of not obligated and sketchy. It is there all the time.
Noma, have you ever found, I don't know, somebody or something, or is there something you always come back to where you can't find that duality, those collisions, those contrasts? Is there a thing where you always think, oh, I hope I don't get a project about whatever it might be, or looking into the certain person's face? Or can you always find that extra depth?
It's coming all the time. And it's never one story, it's never one thing. There's a something in something. It's like mini script. There's one thing that leads to another thing and leads to another thing. So yeah, there all the time, there will be something that will come. I never feel that it's enough to do just one thing. I never took commissions of, can you draw this glass or microphone? Just like a straightforward drawing, it will never was enough for me, and I refuse to take these things. So I keep looking for them, and I know that I'm going to find them. Through the years, I realized that it's easier than I'm thinking, in terms of sometimes things looked impossible when I just started. But today I know that any two words can be illustrated or, you know, be represented visually.
It is summed up perfectly by the title of the collection, Bittersweet, published by Thames and Hudson. It's a beautiful piece of work containing tons of beautiful pieces of work, but it's a pretty monstrous and handsome collection. Noma Barr, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
And Noma Barr's brilliant book, Bittersweet, is available now, published by Thames and Hudson. This is the Monocle Weekly. Now, as I understand it, and I do understand it well because I've seen the schedule and we've already talked about it, we're going to be talking about metal, aren't we? Heavy metal. We will be achieving total heaviosity before the show is out.
I hope so. I hope we shall pepper some clips of heavy metal throughout the interview. Do you think?
There's a sporting chance of that. Here's some distinctly un-metal sounds for you from 2002. It's Wilco from Chicago with, and you'll see what I've done here, heavy metal drummer. And
nice.
I even drummed,
and
the
you
lights
even drummed the lights
by
okay.
accident.
Wilco there with heavy metal drummer from 2002 from their classic album Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Beautiful stuff. You're tuned into the Monocle Weekly off to Belgrade. Next.
Now, we did already mention this. Next week on Thursday, Monocle launches its new four-part summer newspaper. Rob, I know you're sad it's only four parts, aren't you?
Very sad it's only four
parts. Looking forward to
it
being an ongoing
particularly, yeah.
project in perpetuity.
Yeah.
The Monocle Summer Weekly is genuinely very, very exciting. There's virtually nothing you can't do with newsprint. Leave that to your imaginations. But the title, Monocle Summer Weekly, may have echoes of familiarity to our listeners to a certain radio show, by which I mean this very one, Rob.
Is it the summer Monocle Summer Weekly?
It is.
Well, this is a briefing landing on newsstands and in mailboxes each week through August, celebrating the best of the season. And to give you a flavour of the kind of stories you might expect, here's Monocle's Guy Delaunay on his toughest assignment yet, sampling ice cream in his home city of Belgrade, which over the past 3 years has quietly become Southeast Europe's gelato capitale.
Once upon a time, there was a Monocle reader called Moritz Fried. Fed up of banking, he decided to add some flavour to his life and to that of the denizens of Belgrade's old town. Naturally, he called his venture Moritz Ice. And for the past few years, it's been serving gelato and sorbet sourced from local ingredients in beautifully designed surroundings.
I came to a stage in my life where I was wondering what I really want to do in my life, and I thought I need to do my own thing. I need to create my own business, and Serbia has a fantastic potential for agricultural goods. You have an unparalleled quality of fruits and vegetables, in many instances actually organic, however not always certified, but de facto organic. It became clear, if you have great fruits and vegetables, you can create great ice cream.
Moritz has gone international. The window of the original shop in Belgrade's old town reveals you can now find Moritz ice in Budapest, Cluj, Bucharest, Novi Sad and Porto Montenegro. The other window, even more awe-inspiring, starting with Santiago de Chile and ending up with Chahagua, which I'm not even sure how to pronounce. There's even a concession at Belgrade Airport, so you can stock up on Moritz ice before you fly to these exotic locales.
We import our chocolates directly from Belgium. We import our vanilla from Madagascar. I'm extremely focused on offering the best, because as soon as a person comes into the shop and tastes the product, they tend to get hooked, and then they will come and become repeated buyers and bring their friends and families and boyfriends and girlfriends. And that's how I believe it is the right way to build my business.
How do you think that you've reinvented ice cream, and what have you done that's distinctive and different?
I did not have any legacy related to this business, so I had a completely, I could start from zero. I had absolutely no perceptions to what it would mean to do ice cream before, and hence we created, I think, a complete new concept. The atmosphere we have created, we're trying to make this not just a typically an ordinary ice cream shop, but actually almost like a lifestyle experience. So people come in, they get special attention, they get a very good product, they are in a beautiful, very clean environment.
Kralja Petra is one of the oldest streets in Belgrade. You can hear the cars going along the cobbles, but as late afternoon turns into early evening, it's also one of the busiest outside Sarna Ovsa, or Black Sheep, with the cars triple parked and a big queue snaking out of the door as people wait to try and get their favourite ice cream flavours.
We started by eating really good ice cream in Italy, and thinking about bringing it to Belgrade, you know. Between the idea and the realization, we needed 2.5 years.
I came from US, and he's my old friend, so he called me and told me what he's up to, and then it was just really interesting because in US they also started with certain things in Seattle, like experimenting with new flavors and smaller shops and like ice cream labs, so that was really interesting to me, and I just decided to get involved with them.
Zoran Jevtovic and Irena Skarapnakic are two of the young Serbian team behind Sarna Ovsa. They admit they were inspired by Moritz ice, but they've taken the flavours in another direction, and they've dazzled local palates with flavours which first raise the eyebrows and then cheers. Things like gorgonzola, walnut and pear.
Sometimes we like one flavor and another flavor, so we mix these two flavors, put something also in them, and we make sesame coffee with chocolate coffee beans.
It has a good one, huh?
Yeah, that one was really good because it was really creative process, and I remember when I just started working, they were making something and then there was us working in a pult. And then we were trying sesame, we were trying coffee, then we were thinking, oh, maybe try this coffee, make it from this coffee or that one. And then it's kind of like a lot of trying and basically people saying what they think, like among us, and then just kind of everything all adds up and we came to that flavor. It was just not like, oh, we have this one and da 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 da. It was really process of making a lot of small portions, trying, mixing and leveling it, and then actually how we get to that flavor, for example.
This place is so successful that the street outside, Kralja Petra, which is I think just about the oldest street in Belgrade, at a certain time of the evening, what the Italians might call passeggiata time, it's completely blocked, triple parked with cars and a huge queue of people snaking out trying to get their ice cream from Sarna Ovsa.
This actually surprised us, yes. And I admit I'm guilty for it. For the parking problems, yes. Huh? But I'm not paying for any, you know, the parking tickets and fees for parking. You know, so,
they're kind of missing the point of a passeggiata, aren't they? So that's Austrian and Serbian ice cream so far, but we couldn't have a roundup of Belgrade's ice cream dreams without covering the joy of Italian gelato. Paolo Bormana came from Bergamo to open his shop, Sapore, in the old town of Belgrade.
I think the difference between me and them are I want to use just to prepare just simple taste, because I don't want to prepare too much elaborated flavor. Because it's really nice when you taste really peach, just melon, good chocolate, not to use a lot of ingredient and to lose really the quality for one taste. This is my concept. For me, the priority is to use good milk and fresh ingredient. A lot of people come first time and they are really satisfied, they are really surprised how is good the product. And for me it's very important when I saw that people come back again. This is for me very, very satisfaction.
And with a 1 kilometer long pedestrian promenade between Republic Square and Kalemegdan Park, Belgrade has the perfect place for a leisurely passeggiata. Ice cream most definitely required. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Guy Delaunay talking to the ice cream artisans of Belgrade. They're real people, Rob. It's just a small helping of the kinds of stories.
A spoof Monocle story.
We'll be covering in the Monocle Summer Weekly each week. You can pick up your first copy of the first edition from Thursday of this week.
And you can enjoy more of that very kind of thing right here too, as the original Monocle Weekly slips on its shorts and chaise through August and brings some unashamedly sunny, summery, possibly sexy stuff to your ears to complement
definitely,
that on the printed
definitely,
page,
definitely
Tom.
Sexy.
What do we think?
Definitely
yeah?
sexy.
Yeah?
Layered. Colon, the Robert Bound story. No. No, I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to read the first edition.
Me too.
Rob, I think it's time to end the show with a light helping of heavy metal. Maybe not a genre...
A little bit like a big fat slice of Thin Lizzy.
Exactly,
yeah.
Okay. Not necessarily the genre you would... generally hear that much about Monocle 24.
Not a lot. We don't get a lot of heavy metal, but luckily we've got someone who can talk us through it. It's never too late, also, even on Monocle 24, to learn how to differentiate your Black Sabbaths from your Bathories, your Megadeths from your Maidens. And to give us a primer, we're very lucky to be joined by the comedian and the author, Andrean O'Neill. He's just published his new book, A History of Heavy Metal, profiling the genre he loves, and he's here right now. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Absolute pleasure.
Now, when Tom and I were walking down the stairs, you heard us saying the opening line of your book, which I should repeat in order to drag people towards this fine title, which is, there are two types of people in the world, heavy metal fans and dicks.
Yep.
I think this is a good fighty opener for you. Now, this is something, I get the feeling also this might have been part of the opening line for your stand-up.
That was very much the opening salvo in the stand-up show.
So tell us how it came together. I mean, obviously you're a fan, you look like a fan, you breathe like a fan, you've got the book to prove it. What was the Damascene conversion? Version for you as a young man, as a young boy, what happened?
It was probably Queen. I was probably watching Queen's 86 Wembley show, which I taped off the telly watched again. No, the one that followed Live Aid.
Okay.
So they did Live Aid, and then before they did Live Aid, everybody thought they were lame and old news.
Yeah.
But mainly because they'd done a rubbish disco album. And then and then they did Live Aid, and because they'd been touring stadiums around the world, they absolutely knew how to play a stadium. So Freddie, you watched that film, Freddie's owning the stage, going to every corner of the stage. And everybody for the rest of the gig just went, shit. Okay,
yeah, right.
Okay. And then they had a big resurgence in the UK, and they did a stadium tour and played Wembley, and that was on Channel 4. And I watched that over and over and over again, and wanted to be Freddie Mercury, and then wanted to be Brian May, and then
wanted to be John Deacon.
Wow.
Surprise, surprise.
I don't think John Deacon
Poor
wants
John.
To be
Poor John.
John Deacon doesn't want to be John Deacon. So. and just the guitar absolutely sort of beguiled me. And then I grew up listening to with Radio 2 on in the background, just constantly on. And so this incredible sort of diet of 50s, 60s, 70s rock. And my dad was a Beatles fan. And it was just anything that sounded heavy drew me. And then it was Hendrix, Public Enemy, some of my favourite bands when I was a kid. And then Nirvana very briefly. And at that point, it was a definite search for something heavier. Then it was Metallica. They blew the doors off. And then it was a matter of months before I descended into Cannibal Corpse and Deicide and Morbid Angel. So it's like a kind of it's like a drug addiction. You get used to the hit you get off a certain level of heaviness, and then you require more. And from that point there was no turning back.
Wow, Andrew, that's already kind of amazing, and I'm interested in that sort of like genealogy. And obviously the book kicks off with this, and it's a bit of a thread that runs through, which is how you get to these gradients of heaviosity. How important is that? Because I guess some people would say, oh, this is a sort of, you know, the metal, the rockers inside, the rockers like inside of you, it matters. But and people will say, hang on, he said Nirvana and Public Enemy and it started with Queen. Does it matter how you get there as long as you just get there?
Absolutely not. And even in terms of the development of metal itself, my theory is that if Black Sabbath had never happened, metal still would have happened because of all that hard rock that came after Sabbath in the 70s. Now, I mean, people get there all sorts of ways. Most people have embarrassing entries in. I was really lucky in that when I was getting into heavy metal, it was a good period for the mid-90s. So the bands that were on the front of Kerrang were bands like Sepultura, Pantera, Machine Head, bands that are kind of properly metal. I mean, they all went rubbish. There's a chapter in the book called In the 90s, Every Band I Love Went Shit. But for me, it was a good period for extreme music. But no, I mean, metal's very democratic, and as far as most metalheads are concerned, within all subcultures, there's snobbery. But as far as most of us are concerned, if you dig the music, you're in. That's it. You don't need to wear the shirts. You don't need to know who produced what. If you like the music, you're absolutely in, because that's what it's about. There's a big difference, isn't there, in gender between the way men and women sort of in their sort of social induction appreciate music. And guys have that kind of the cultural currency of knowledge. You know, they know who's the names of all the people in the bands, when it was produced, and women tend to just like it. Idiots. You know, that's sort of like notion, all right, you know, what album's that from? I don't know, I just listened to it. Yeah. I was watching Slayer once, and they surprised
just us. Just drop that in.
Down Slayer once.
I've probably seen them 20 times. And they started playing Seasons in the Abyss, the album, all the way through. But they didn't announce it, so they just started playing the songs in sequence. And by the third song, we were kind of going, oh, this is exciting. And this guy next to me, most way through the album, said, what's this one called? And I went, oh, I don't know. He went, but you know all the words. I'm like, yeah. I haven't learned.
Track three.
Yeah,
track
like, three, it was, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So no, it absolutely doesn't matter where it comes from. If something strikes you, then that's what, you know, music's abstract and it gets you in the heart, it gets you in the feels. It bypasses particularly stuff like heavy metal because it's so visceral. It bypasses the intellectual parts of your brain, which is why if someone goes, I just don't like it, there's no argument to be made. I mean, when I was 14, I would have gone, well, if you like that, then I'd try and plot a path to the bands I like from the ones you like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll put an asterisk on that. See earlier Dick's comment.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So there's no good way or bad way to get to it. I think that nearly everybody, the vast majority of people, anyone who's got anything like taste will find something in metal that they like.
Is there something about, I mean, we all probably have an Iron Maiden album, right? Mm-hmm. We all have a Black Sabbath album. That first album is a masterpiece of any sort of music.
Yeah.
But are there must be sort of grades of quality within that. Now, there must be the Highway 61 Revisited and the Pet Sounds within metal.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Touchstones and the kind of part of the canon, and obviously now part of that music has become part of the rock canon, the music canon. So what is what? But then also you need to spice it up with a bit of something that people hardly anyone's heard of.
Deep cuts.
Yeah. Exactly, right. So talk us through those things, because you starting off with Queen. What was the thing that kind of got you into metal? Did you go straight into the stuff that was big in the 90s, in the early 90s, when Britpop and grunge was happening?
It was, so it was, yeah, kind of, so from Queen, listening to Public Enemy and Queen, and then when I was 10, there was that Simpsons thing, The Blues was on heavy rotation. Yeah. And the
Everybody Did the Bartman.
Yeah, the yeah. MC Hammer album I had on tape. And then no, so Nirvana was a brief thing for me, but I've realised why it slipped past, because the production on Nevermind is terrible, and it's so overproduced and it's so shiny, and it's got and it just kind of, I don't know, it sounds horrible. But the Black Album, so Metallica's 91 release, which I think I first listened to in about 92, that's their gateway album, because what they were doing with that, having written extreme metal albums up to that, they did the video for One, which was their first promo video, then realised that they were playing to three times the numbers of people, and they suddenly realised that there was this attainable size they'd never previously considered. So they made a radio-friendly album, and I was on tour with my band, and they radio show we were playing, listening to, played three songs off the Black Album in a row, and it just sounds perfect in a car, on a car stereo, on FM radio, those frequencies, and yeah. That's exactly what it's maximised for, that FM radio car stereo sort of sound. So yeah, for me, that was the gateway, and that was the one that kind of got me into, and then I went back through their back catalogue. So literally going back, so Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets, and Justice for All, Master of Puppets, Ride the Lightning, and then Kill 'Em All. And they get kind of heavier and kind of more raw as they go back. And then it was Slayer, Rain in Blood, which I had on a tape. The other side had Dareside's Once Upon the Cross, which is an incredibly brutal album.
Yeah.
And then it was just a case of like picking up, because my mates were all into this stuff, and it was very easy for me to go, that sounds good, give me that, that sounds really good, give me that. And then there was of course, the danger of the rise of new metal in 94, 95, 96. Ooh,
spelled NU, obviously.
And spelled NU, yeah. And it's with its wacky sort of mall kind of sleeves over your hands.
Yeah.
That sort of
which
suburban
is kind of skater
wackiness.
There was a bit of slacker skater thing coming into metal.
It's
there.
Like metal for people that are embarrassed by the trappings of metal, which is and that stuff was happening in the 90s anyway. I mean, this is where black metal came from. And again, like all these subgenres, like you sort of touched on this. The map is not the territory. The subgenre labels aren't that important. It's just it's a shorthand for describing a sound, a look, a part of the sort of scene. And before Venom, it was all just heavy metal. It was all in one thing. And doing my research, realizing that I was going through back copies of Smash Hits, and Smash Hits features, you know, New Kids on the Block, Kylie and Jason, and the latest Diamond Head and Motorhead releases.
Wow.
Which I just didn't realise, because I grew up when metal was removed from the rest of the kind of morass of pop culture. But that thing, like, you know, the Young Ones has Madness and Motorhead and a load of other bands. But then it with extreme metal, it becomes, I guess, kind of slightly ghettoized. So we have our own metal magazines, and you read that, and you don't, you know, there's like the kids at school read Enemy and the kids who read Metal
Hammer. Is that the thing then? Is that the thing? Is that part of the joy of metal as well? Is the clubability?
Yeah,
hugely. Is the kind of like, is the two fingers up to the mainstream sort of thing? That is part of the joy of it. But is it nice to see, you know, an Iron Maiden album at number one in the charts, or does it leave you cold? Is it nice to kind of have the kind of outsider status?
It's both. The thing is, I think this is sometimes talked about in a kind of arse about tit way, because it's less about rejecting the mainstream and much more about finding something that you belong to. So it's a pull factor rather than a push factor.
Okay.
Metal feels at home to me. Wearing a band shirt, wearing a bullet belt, you know, having long hair. These are things that I would feel uncomfortable not doing. I couldn't, like, I've considered cutting my hair for microseconds. I have stress dreams in which I've decided to cut my hair. And it's not, you know, it's not necessarily about a sort of middle finger to the mainstream, because Bruce Dickinson is a Tory, you know.
Yeah, and, with a pilot's license, famously.
And you know, K.K. Downing of Judas Priest, ex-Judas Priest, owns a golf course and has his own perfume range.
So does Alice Cooper, though, right? I mean, this is he's got a handicap of two or something.
Alice Cooper's a massive Republican.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is that thing where the you know, it's much more about finding things you identify with as an outsider. As, and I've always grown up, you know, I'm when people read my press releases, which I'm always grateful when interviewers don't, oh, so you're these things, you know. Yeah. I'm vegan, I'm a transvestite, I'm, you know, my politics are anarchist, I'm a metalhead, I'm a punk, I'm in a steampunk band, and all these things, people go, oh, these are interesting. I'm like, yeah, but actually I'm plugging a comedy show, if we can talk about that. the kind of like tick list of the things I am.
Yeah, yeah.
But growing up, I always felt like a weirdo and an outsider, and so I was drawn to things like Freddie Mercury's flamboyance, yeah, you know, or Public Enemy's political take, that, you know, as literally a 10-year-old listening to Chuck D's excoriating take on race politics. I was like, that's cool. And it was with a sort of suburban existence, you know, fairly comfortable suburban existence, it was a feeling of escaping that into something much more interesting, something a bit more real, something a bit more visceral, as opposed to the life that stretched away of, you know, kids and going to B&Q at the weekend, you know?
Where are the best places to go and see metal, heavy metal? Like in London, this show's listened to all over the world, and I know there is a huge kind of South American metal scene, like massive.
Oh yeah, there's huge.
The rest of it. But where's front and centre for London, for example?
Well, there are a few really amazing venues. There's the Unicorn on Camden Road, which has live music, free live music every night, and that's just at the end of my road. And they'll a massive range of stuff. The Dome in or the Boston Arms, it's all part of one building. That's become a centre again for metal shows. There's the Black Heart in Camden.
Oh yeah, of course.
Which the upstairs room is you know, and again, and you can go there and see a band that are playing to three mates, or you can there's a band that's a show that's sold out. There's the underground scene, and it sort of, you know, obviously venues are closed. I think 40% of venues in the country have closed over the last 5 years, which is just devastating. But people need to get off their asses and support live bands. You know, they need to go and see bands. They need to buy their shirts. They need to, you know, like, to keep these bands on the road, because with inflation, you know, beer prices have gone up, fuel prices have gone up, touring is much, much more expensive. And I can get the price of beer is very much a part of the price of touring. But ticket prices haven't gone up that as much. And so when people now complain, oh, I'm not paying £20 for a ticket. Well, that's the equivalent of £12 in 1996. Yeah. So, you know, people need to support these venues, to go to these venues, buy beer, to support the venues and buy bands' merch. Like across the board, rather than there's a trend with the internet of only going to see stuff you've heard or you've seen, because you've got access to so much. But that means the live circuit will die.
I would recommend A History of Heavy Metal to absolutely anyone. It's so amusingly written, so well researched, and you don't have to know anything or heavy metal in any way to understand it. It is a mean cultural history. Andrew O'Neill is the author. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And that was edition 422 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom. I thoroughly enjoyed presenting that programme with you, and I thoroughly enjoyed all our guests, and the whole thing was wonderful, and I'm glad I came in.
It was great, and it's sort of the irresistible seeping sunshine. That sounds a bit horrible and insidious. I didn't mean it to sound that way. But there's a sunshine feeling affecting, obviously, the newspaper, which is heading to newsstands, this programme today. There's more coming in the weeks ahead.
I think this is very much like almost like a blackout blind. And this afternoon on Monocle 24, we've rolled it up, you know, just enough to maybe sort of wake yourself up in the morning. And as the weeks progress, suddenly we will be having a sort of, who knows, by week four of the Summer Weekly, possibly it will be like the very early, slightly tragic days of TVAM.
Absolutely. But it will be like a solarium.
Yeah, right? Well, it'll be
piping
amazing.
Hot, absolutely piping
absolutely
hot.
Absolutely amazing. You might be able to touch anything. Yeah. We'll all be running for our factor 75, right? My favourite thing about TVAM is that those, and this is probably something you well know, being a former Camdenite.
They're still there.
The eggs are still there. Yeah. It still gives me a little bit of a Proustian rush of thinking, well, it's quite glamorous walking around. You're kind of like, this was a TV studio that used to work, and it used to be super cool, and it used to be amazing, and all the stuff that in MTV used to be in there, and all the rest of it. Kind of cool. No one knows what we're talking about. The eggs that were part of the great, great, great breakfast show.
But Rob, let them discover.
Go to the YouTube section of the internet.
Exactly.
And look it up.
All will be revealed.
Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Week will be back same time, same place. Who knows? Possibly same personnel next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.